Welcome, everybody. Before we get started today, I wanted to highlight an opportunity because we're going to be talking quite a bit about the Chess Dojo today. I've gone ahead and partnered with the Chess Dojo for the next 2 weeks. If you want to use the code Dr. Skull, DRSCULL, you can actually get 25% off the first month of a monthly Chess Dojo subscription. You may find after listening to this episode that you really want to give it a try. I think this is a great way to do it. Supports the show, helps get you a good deal on a great product. Now, on with the show. Welcome back to episode 102 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here at Chess Journeys, we talk about both the highs and glories of rating gains and my current pit of despair. I think USCF and I are about to have a divorce. It's just got to be that way. I lost 40 points in my tournament that wrapped up last night, basically from one game, which is absurd. So I don't know what to do anymore, USCF. I'm done with you. You could rate me all you want, but I'm not looking at it. All right. If you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. And I want to thank Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donald Rich Burgess, Brandon Hulside, David Shriver, Lindsay Newell, Jeff Peterson, and Tobias Rex. You want to get merch on the merch store? You can do that. My daughter and I made some new mugs. I said on a recent podcast that she did not get any of the proceeds, and then someone bought one and was like, I want her to get half the proceeds. So, you know, if you want her to get some proceeds, just message me and we can make that happen, I guess. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe a rook eraser. That sounds good. All right. I have been streaming quite a bit on Dr. Skull _ Tiny Grimes. We're doing calculation work. We're doing games, all kinds of stuff. If you want to appear on the show, a good place to go is the Google form in the show notes. We all are interested in your story. If you're interested in Noel Studer's next level training program, well, you can use the code in the show notes, and that also supports the show. Okay, enough of that. We are time for our moment of the hour. We bring on Michael, otherwise known as Nose Knows All, and he is an applied mathematician with a PhD in mathematics. That sounds pretty impressive. That sounds harder than my PhD in history. I'm just going to say that. He's a dedicated adult improver. In fact, he was on the Perpetual Chess episode 247 as one of those super improvers. This was about a year and a half ago, so I thought we could follow up with him. And I was especially drawn to his post on Reddit where he talked about chess books. And so we're going to talk today about his journey, his books experience, and also he's a big Chess Dojo guy. I've been waiting to talk to somebody about that. So we got a lot of topics at hand. I'm guessing 7 hours. Michael, welcome to the show, and have you played any chess yet today?
Thank you very much for having me. Technically, I have not played much chess recently because I've got this new puppy at home. So we're week two of a slightly different adventure than my usual. So a lot of biting, a lot of craziness, and not much chess besides the occasional bullet just to relieve some stress. But not much.
New puppies are a lot. They're very interesting because I've had both puppies and babies. Babies take longer to grow into the like potty training stage. So good news with the puppy, it won't be too long, hopefully.
Yeah, we're hoping.
Okay. I did play one chess game today. It was a 3-2 game, and we both ended with 100% accuracy. Very rare. They disconnected after 5 moves, so I got the rare 100-100 win.
There you go.
That USCF. You can tell me my rating's going down, but that says otherwise.
Yeah, Stockfish doesn't lie either.
That's great. All right. I think we should start with your backstory. I know some people might have heard a little bit about it on the Perpetual Chess episode, but did you play as a kid at all? Did you pick this up as an adult? How'd you get into chess?
Yeah, I played like a tiny bit as a kid, but I never really got into it. Definitely never got to the point where I was playing a tournament or any like over the board actual games, just occasionally online and like Yahoo Chess or, you know, playing with the grandma kind of thing. But basically, senior year of college, I got diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, actually, which was a big shock to me. And I couldn't really do any of the things that I like to do. You know, I'm now a PhD student, so you can tell that I'm like really into academics and really into learning and stuff like that. And I just couldn't do anything. I was just so knocked out. And so I was looking around and my girlfriend, now wife, basically said, hey, why don't you like look at chess? That's something that, you know, you could possibly do when you're like in a hospital bed. And yeah, that was completely correct. I was in fact interested in chess. I picked it up pretty quickly. Carlsen versus Anand was happening right then, like within a few weeks of me starting. It was a super event, got super into it and never looked back.
And the Queen's Gambit came out, what, like a month later?
The Queen's Gambit came out close to 10 years later.
Oh, so. Pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So that is a tragic way to get into chess. Are you fully recovered?
Yeah. Everything's been totally fine. Oh. I had 8 months of getting knocked down, and that's when the chess really started picking up. And then after that, it was 2 years of maintenance chemo where it was like pretty, I'll say chill, but it was not, you know, pleasant when that did happen, but it wasn't actually life altering anymore for those 2 years. And since 2016, everything's been completely fine. No issues whatsoever.
That's awesome. So you had a trial by fire there. You learned chess in the process. So I don't know, probably still a horrible experience,
yeah, but
at least we got something out of it.
Yeah. The silver lining is real. The silver lining is real.
So how quickly did your chess take off? Like, were you able to spend quite a bit of time on chess? You said you were knocked out. So were you able to actually spend a lot of time on chess, or was it kind of like just dabbling?
I mean, it was definitely just dabbling, but I was so bad that I was at the level where like basic tactics were new to me. And it doesn't take too much like mental energy to see a fork and to see a pin and actually be like, oh, whoa, this is like something I can learn from. So we're talking like, I think 1100 Lee chess, we're bottom of the barrel really for the beginning. And working on chess at the time would be like watching a Chess Network video, doing some casual tactics on an app kind of thing. Apps were pretty bad at the time, but you know, still found some that worked, some pretty good options.
Did you use CT Art by any chance?
I never got a chance to actually pick that one up. I was using much worse ones, honestly, than what I've heard about CT Art. Yeah, CT Art sounds great.
Yeah, you didn't catch the one good one.
Exactly.
Okay. So you got some random app tactics practice going on. What time control are you playing back then?
Anything and everything. So if I had, you know, 2 minutes, I'd play a bullet game. Didn't really like bullet. Couldn't figure it out. It was terrible. Usually I was playing 5-0 in the beginning. And then I very quickly realized that 5-0 is way too short and I needed a lot more time. So within, I would say, a year to 2 years of me starting chess, I had actually kind of converged to 15 plus 10 being the correct time control for me. So that's been the one the Lee Chess rapid rating has been like the one that I've cared about the most and the one that I've like try-hearted the hardest for the longest since the very beginning. Although originally it was actually called classical time control, which is a little bit odd. But yeah, 15 plus 10 is kind of the one that I like the most.
Okay. So you moved to 15, 10. Feels like gives you just enough time to actually be able to think, but it's not too long that it just goes on forever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about this maybe a little bit later, but like the OTB games, when you're in it for like 4 hours, 4.5 hours, 5 hours, I get like so invested and so into it that like I can feel my heart rate at like 180 for like 2 hours in a row. And I know it's not healthy, but like, it's just, it's a rush and you get that in 15:10, but then you can calm down again. It ends in, you know, 30 minutes. So you actually have a chance, 45 minutes.
Interesting. I think another problem for me personally is I've tried to do like 45 games on my computer, and in person I can be focused, but there aren't a million flashing things around me. It's very hard when I'm sitting at my computer and my opponent takes like 8 minutes to really explore a position. After about 5 minutes, I'm like in my email and on something else. And I'm like, oh, Kevin, what are you doing? You're not going to win this game doing that. Have you tried that at all? Does that work for you?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting you say that because I've never had that issue. Like when I get into the game, the entire world just becomes the game. So nice. I get super focused, even for like a 15:10, but I haven't done too many long games, but I just came back from the Chicago Open a month ago. And in preparation for that, I was playing someone who was like 2000 and change OTB. And we played a 90-30 game online. And it was just like focus, 4 hours, really intense, spicy tactics, everything. And it was, it really wasn't an issue for me. And I don't think it ever has been an issue. So I guess I'm pretty lucky in that regard.
Yeah, I was able to do it for a while. For a while, I wasn't playing every week OTB. And so on Mondays, I scheduled a time with a person and I was able to do it. And then once I started playing every Wednesday OTB, those Monday things, I started losing my focus. And I was like, it's not the same thing. I don't know. I'm having a problem tricking myself into saying, no, it is the same thing. So we'll see.
Definitely the one for me that it's like whatever I care most about is the one that I'm able to focus most on. And since I haven't actually played that many OTB games, I think I've got like 30 or 40 tops. the rapid online stuff and the classical online stuff becomes the one that I like actually care more about. So I do focus on this a lot.
Maybe that's what I should do. I should just get my divorce with USCF and then just play Lee Chess Classical. And that's my main time control.
There you go.
USCF, I don't care about you anymore. I'll play in your events, but I don't care about you.
Yeah.
So hard to not care. So hard. Okay. So initially, you're just doing some tactics. You're playing. What's your rating climbing to in this period?
So now I'm over 2,400 on Lee Chess Rapid, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's a big number.
I've got, I think 22 to 2,300 blitz is kind of accurate. Not quite for chess.com, but for Lee Chess, I am there. And just after the Chicago Open, I was in the under 2,100 section and my performance was close to 2,100. So I'm now 1,911 USCF, which is a big climb.
Yeah, that's a big number.
Yeah.
I guess I want to dive back though a bit before we get to modern day.
Sure.
So what was your rating like once you just kind of did some tactics and played a bit? You said you started at 1100. What were you able to climb to just kind of doing the basics?
Doing the bare, I won't say bare minimum, but like the not studying and just playing and occasionally watching like Chess Network videos. I got to 1600 Lee Chess Blitz, maybe 1700 or 1800 Lee Chess Rapid. But just around then, which would be, I think, 2018 or so. So this was now 4 years of just me not really getting too into chess, but always kind of playing chess in the background. I decided like, wait, this is like a lot of fun and I should really get into it. And I heard about Silman's Reassess Your Chess. So I picked up that book and very slowly started going through it, kind of got some friends to come join me. And we were like doing it online and like pre-Discord era, kind of like Skype and TeamSpeak type things. couldn't really stream.
Is that your
but
first chess book?
My first chess book, technically, when I started, I told a friend I'm into chess and he was actually someone who was already 1700 over the board. And he said, these are the two books you need. And he gave me Amazon link to Polgar's The Meat and Two book, the monolith ginormous book.
Yeah.
And he gave me a link to First Book of Morphy. And the Polgar book, I did maybe somewhere between 300 and 500 of those mates, and I just could not do it. It was not holding my interest. It was way too massive. It was way too big. It was way too hard. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot, but it wasn't a lot because the mate and ones go by pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And I just could not, I just couldn't do it. So I went through First Book of Morphy, and I didn't really go through it fully, but I was like kind of opening up analysis boards online and just kind of like sort of reading it, sort of getting some juice from it, but not like super analyzing anything. And that was kind of all I needed to get to this 1700 kind of Lee Chess rating.
Okay. So in that period, you get to 1700, you read the First Book of Morphy, which is like such a great book, by the way. My daughter and I are going through it. There's like a whole section on opening principles and it shows how each of Morphy's games do that. And then we haven't even gotten to the strategy section. We just got there. So it's been, I found it to be a lot of fun. Even for me at my level, I get something out of each game. So I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a really good book. I do also recommend it. I found that it was, it was actually too hard for me then as well. I would focus more on the text and less on the chess because I just couldn't handle it too much. But some of those finishes are just like chef's kiss, you know what I mean? Like they're so beautiful. Knight in the corner mates, queen sacks. Oh, yeah. Morphy's great. So he definitely ignited the interest, but not so much the me improving.
Yeah, what I like is he plays, or my daughter plays a lot like Morphy. So we do this thing where we try to guess Morphy's moves and she guesses his move more often than I do. I'll be like, no, let's just play positionally. And she's like, no, we're going to jam our bishop in here. And I'm like, that's suicide. You can't do that. And then Morphy does. And I'm like, son of a.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
fun to go through that. Okay, so you get to 1700, you discover the joy that is Silliman's Reassess Your Chess.
Yeah.
Which volume is this, by the way? Because the difference between the third and the fourth is like 800 pages.
Yeah, I did get the fourth one. I think the fourth one was recently out, actually, when I got it. But yeah, I did get the big book of Silliman. And everyone now is very, it's a contentious subject. Silliman is a contentious author because his language is so flowery, right? He's always trying to make metaphors and go kind of like beyond the chessboard. Mm-hmm. But I personally, I found it really enlightening. I was actually able to really get into his view of stuff. And that was the first time that I actually realized like there was something besides Morphy. You didn't actually have to go for the throat. You didn't have to sacrifice brilliantly. So that was like the very beginnings of me even like hearing the term good knight, bad bishop. I'd never heard that before. Never thought about a weak square before. Never thought about the knight getting to d5, you know, just like this perfect piece kind of thing. Hadn't heard about doing like a pawn break. You know, I knew some pawn breaks just from my openings, but I hadn't really like thought about it in terms of like, how does it activate the pieces and stuff like that. So it definitely really opened my eyes in a way that had not happened before. And over 2018, because it legitimately took me a year to go through that book.
Oh yeah.
I suddenly became a different player, and I was playing much more principled chess and actually improved like 200 rating points over the year because I was playing a lot. I was going through the book. I would go, you know, back and forth, look at my games, compare it to what happened in the book. And yeah, really, really took off at that point.
Yeah. I think what I find very interesting about strategy books is I feel like everyone's first strategy book is their favorite because that's the book that taught you about this whole world of chess you didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
For me, it's Ludwig Pachman's Modern Chess Strategy. For a lot of older players, it's Nimzowitsch's My System. And a lot of modern players hate that book. But it's kind of like that thing of, if that was your first strategy book, then it was amazing. It unlocked this whole new world for you. So it makes total sense of why so many people recommend it.
Yeah.
So I guess I have this question, though. Do you think, or did you for a long time think in terms of Silliman's like imbalances? Or did you just kind of like take these strategical ideas and put them in your games?
I don't think I kind of synthesized his big thesis about like the whole world is only imbalances. I don't think I really got it. Maybe I still don't get it. Maybe it's still too too high above me. But the building blocks became part of my chess, but not some overarching like, oh, everything is an imbalance. No.
Okay. Because I think that might be the thing that I've heard people criticize, right? Is that it's like the imbalance thing. They're trying to like think about the game in terms of imbalances. And I kind of feel like that's something extra. And it's more just get the strategical concepts. And I also, it's funny because I both dislike how big it is and like it. Because like you, I found that when I'm immersed in a book for a long time, I really start seeing that stuff in my games. And then once I stop with that book, I stop seeing that stuff in my games, and it's very frustrating because I'm like, wait, no, I'm done with the book. I should know this stuff now. And my brain's like, no, you've just moved on to other things. We're concentrating on that now. And I'm like, so there's like certain books where I feel like I'd probably be better at chess if I just read the same book over and over like 7 times just to keep my brain immersed in that material. But I don't know how the human brain works, Michael. My PhD in history didn't actually educate me in that very well.
Well, I will say that I have read Silliman's Reassess Your Chess the most out of all the books. Mm. So I've gone through it probably 3 times total, like front to back.
Oh,
and I've done the exercises, which I thought the exercises were what made the book really, really good because his explanations were like really clean. Mm. And the exercises themselves were like super interesting.
Yeah.
And I like how he kind of gave it an OTB rating because then I could kind of feel like, oh, even though I've never played an OTB game in my life, like, oh, I could be 1200. Like, that's not
bad. Yeah.
That's
cool.
So yeah, what? I did that. And then I also did the workbook that corresponded, I think, with the previous edition, but still interesting. Still.
Let's talk real quick about this idea of revisiting chess books, because it's something I've struggled with so much because there are at least 100 books on my list of books I want to read. and I have a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
And so it's so hard for me, no matter how much I love a book, to be like, I should go back and read that again. So Michael, sell me. Why is it worth going back, especially to a giant tome like Reassess Your Chess multiple times?
Yeah. Well, at least for me, in particular with that book, the first time I read it, my OTB rating would have been something like maybe 1200, right? So the book is not necessarily geared to just 1200s. It's geared to anywhere between 1200 and 2200 in his words. My words, I would say anywhere from 1200 to maybe 1800. But there was so much that I just had to skip. There was so much that I just couldn't, when it got to too many variations, when it got to too deep of an idea and I just didn't get it, I would just move on and that's fine. And then I would come back to it when I was 1500. And then I was like, I sort of remember this, but like, I just couldn't deal with it. So now let me like, see, can I actually figure it out? Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. So then I was like, all right, you know, if I can, I'll dig into it. If I can't, I'll move on. And then some of the exercises, it had been years basically since the first time I read it again. So did I remember the exercises? Not really. But like, had some of the patterns actually become part of my chess? Yeah, a little bit. So the easier exercises I was actually getting now. And there's like a famous Capablanca queen sacrifice that like, I remember just like, oh, this is such a good one. And that one exercise, like I came back to again, and I was like, I know this one. It's that queen sac.
Nice.
It's great. Okay. So at least for that book, that's the main reason I came back to it. If you want to talk about any book that's really good, find like there's going to be a book that you really like, and there's going to be a book that when you read it, it clicked. And for me, the one that did it the most is Brickhard's Strategic Chess Exercises. And it's a very interesting book where it's only exercises. And then his quote unquote solution is actually just the entire game. Like he takes the solution. And that's like maybe a page or maybe two. And then it just suddenly devolves into him annotating the rest of the game. And sometimes there'll be another exercise later down the line from that same game. And he's like, now we're going to hit exercise, you know, 52. So get there and then you'll finish the game.
Wow.
And okay. It's that book is just so good, in my opinion, that like I've gone back and I've reread it now a few times. And it's just every single time I read it, I now even know the first move sometimes because I've done it a few times. But like, just because you know the move doesn't mean you understand the chess.
Yeah.
So that's the benefit of kind of going back through something and improving again and again with the same material.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you get just a little bit more depth, I would say, more than just like the cursory understanding the first time around.
Okay, that makes sense. This book sounds really interesting specifically. Is it like a positional puzzle kind of book?
Yeah. So all of the exercises, I think there's 90 total. And I think it's 60 are quote unquote middle game and 30 are quote unquote end game. But the line between them is sometimes a little bit vague. Yeah. And every single time it's just a default position, no backstory, no information about who the players are. You're just thrown into a position, white to move. You don't know if you're better. You don't know if you're equal. You don't know if you're losing.
Oh, nice.
Okay. And basically try and find the best move. And as it turns out, a lot of the time they're critical positions where there's an important pawn break that you need to play right now or need to set up immediately, or there's a really bad piece of yours and you need to find a way to activate it. And so like things like that are just general positions where, it's all engine checked and actually really quite correct that there's really only one way forward that either maximizes your advantage or holds equality or doesn't lose. Really good positional exercises. Not easy. I would recommend it only for 1600 plus OTB and maybe even a little bit higher than that. It's they're pretty difficult, but they're really, really good.
All right. So maybe for me, USCF says maybe not. I don't know. I was as high as 1756, but and then it's been a tumble. You said this is by Brickhard. Is that right?
Brickhard, Brickard.
Okay. Awesome. I'll definitely check that out. I need another book because I only have like 100 I haven't read yet.
I know, right?
I need to put one more on the pile.
I know.
My family has gotten hilariously good at buying me books. They've got me almost all of the Augard books, and they just sit on a shelf going, if you get good at chess, we're ready for you, man. Just get good at this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried one of those, and then I was like, okay, maybe not. Maybe not now.
I'm not good at chess yet. When I get there, maybe. Okay. So you did reassess your chess. It sounds like you did these chess exercises to kind of like reinforce your chess. Where'd reassess your chess get you? What's your rating now that you finished reassess your chess once?
So the first time I was, call it 1700, because let's say rapid was the only one I care about. I got to close to 2000, I think, with just that book. Okay. And around that time is when I had never even considered openings before. And that's when I like started looking at them and fell into that rabbit hole that everyone falls into where it's like, oh, I got to like explore all these openings. And I just remember one game I played where I had like kind of just learned some openings. So I figured, let me look at like the opening book on Lee Chess, and let me look at the most common opening, the Knight Orphan, and let me look at the most commonly played line, and let me just see what happens. And it was the English attack in the Knight Orphan. Uh-huh. That was the white side of it. And I looked to like move 25 when the book ended, just clicking through the main line. And it's an insane main line where like white sacks a knight on d4 for absolutely no reason. And then black sacks a bishop on e6 and then actually sacks it on b3. And it's like this beautiful, insane nonsense that like is completely irrelevant to anyone who's 2000 Lee Chess, right? Yeah. Right. And I played a classical game on Lee Chess against someone, just a random pool player. And we got literally 23 moves of this one opening. Wow. And he had taken, I think, like 75% of his time to get through that point. And I was pre-moving the entire time. So I was like, oh, I'm a genius. I'm like so good at chess, right? But then we get to the end of this line and I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea what the position is. It's a complete mess. I'm not actually good at chess yet. And I lose pretty quickly. And that was when I realized like, okay, openings are really not what I need to focus on because this did not help me in any way.
Yeah. Lost the game. And what's funny is that dude was already hit the report a cheater button. He's like, this guy is the biggest cheater ever. And then you fall apart and he's like, oh, no. He just memorized a bunch of moves and now he doesn't know what's going on. Got it.
Exactly. So yeah, that really shook me, that one game.
Yeah. What shook me with openings was also the Nidor putting all this time into it and probably 10 over the board games in a row were Close Sicilian, Alapin, Rossellimo. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? This is unfair. I put all this time on the night off and I didn't get to play it.
Yep. Completely agree. I play the Sicilian now and I rarely get the open, maybe just under 50%, honestly, which is still surprising to me.
I mean, that's why I gave up the Sicilian, because at least with the Caro Kann, I always get the Caro Kann. Is it as fun and exciting as the Sicilian? No, but at least I am getting what I am playing for rather than letting my opponent do what they want to do, and most opponents, when they see you play the Caro Kann, they either roll their eyes or they let out a sigh. Like they're upset and you're like, yes, all right, stage one, I've already won.
That's good.
Okay, so you're guaranteeing our listeners 300 points from Silman's Reassess Your Chess. That's pretty good.
At least 200, and then I'll put an asterisk on that extra 100.
Okay. Is it at least 200 if you haven't read a strategy book?
Oh, no, then it's more. Then it's definitely more. Okay. It's then I'd say it's a solid 300. But it's a tome. I mean, as you said, it's a real tome. Yeah. So it's like if you don't have the time, patience, effort to really go through the examples and try and understand them, then you're not going to get that understanding from it. And you might start getting upset at all of his metaphors instead of trying to actually look at the chess itself. It took me a year. And that was the best year for me in terms of like chess improvement, I would say.
I believe that this is Ben Johnson, if you're listening, I'm giving you a gift here. You should have a chess book metaphors episode where you compare Nimzowitsch's My System, Silman's Reassess Your Chess, and Jan Marcos Under the Surface, and you just pull a metaphor out, and the guests, you have a panel, and they have to guess which of the three books the metaphor came from. Oh, what a great show that would be.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Look at me giving ideas to other podcasts. What a generous man I am.
Put me on that panel.
Okay. So you've picked up several hundred points from Silman's Reassess Your Chess. You're over 2,000 Lee Chess. I mean, that's pretty amazing to get the big two in front of your name. What's the next step? Have we played any over-the-board tournaments yet at this point?
No, I'd still not played any OTB. My very first OTB game was January 2019, actually. And a friend of mine was like, dude, you're going through all these books. Because now, once I finished that book, I picked up another book, and that's kind of where it started, right? So I picked up Yusupov, just like the first one, just to see what it was, because I heard some stuff about it. Didn't really go into it yet, but I did go back to it. I picked Life and Games of Michal Tal. Okay. I picked up Sarah Wan's Chess Duels, and I started like going through all these interesting history books, because, you know, that's like really exciting stuff too.
Yeah.
And my friend was like, okay, you're doing this like so hard. You have to play an OTB game. Like, this is getting insane at this point. And I was like, but I'm a starving college kid, or not an undergrad at the time, I was a grad student, and, you know, I can't afford it, and I don't have time, yada yada. And he's like, okay, I will pay for your first tournament.
Wow.
If you get any money in earnings, then you pay me back. But just play an OTB game. And so I played, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think I have it here. Yeah, the Golden State Open in the Bay Area in 2019. And I got a first rating of 1645. And I went 3 wins, 3 losses, 1 draw. So it was like perfectly even in the under 1800 section. And that was the beginning of OTB for me.
Was that your first OTB experience? Like, had you gone to a local chess club or anything?
I had been part of the Berkeley Chess Club, but there was no events. They were all casual blitz play amongst people. And then someone would be playing Bughouse and stuff like that. But it was nothing, nothing serious at any point ever.
But you did play 3D chess before, so that's good.
Yes, but this is an interesting thing. To me, it's never been a problem, actually, going from 2D and 3D. And I think it's because when I was going through Silman, I would put it on the 3D simulation tabletop video game called Tabletop Simulator.
I've used that a lot.
You have used Tabletop Simulator?
Oh, yeah.
So you can play any board game on it. Yeah. One of them you can do is chess. And so I would host a chess park kind of room and just go through this book. Cool. And then some of my friends would like join in, because we couldn't really share screens at the time because the technology wasn't there, but we could all join this 3D room. So yeah, it's never been an issue with me. Even the first time I played OTB in a blitz game against someone, it was always, you know, just about
the same. That's cool. Because you're already playing 3D chess online.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I played a whole bunch of these smaller card games that weren't big enough to actually have real online versions of the card game. So we would build them in Tabletop Simulator and play them there and like physically draw the cards from the deck and stuff. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I did a little bit of that too.
It was a little bit of a nightmare, but that's okay. We have different memories of Tabletop Simulator. Okay, so you go to your first tournament, you get a 1600 rating. Are you happy with that? Are you a little disappointed with that? How did that feel for you?
It was pretty gratifying to finally get an OTB rating. The games were not very stressful to me because I didn't really care yet about OTB, right? Because like the Lee Chess Rapid rating is the one that I cared the most about. So when I lost a long end game, by the way, I was playing the Kara at the time. I played the Kara and the French, I think, at that point. And I played someone who did the what's C4 against the Kara called? It's like the accelerated bot Panov or something like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I had never seen that before. Like, I just never once, no one has ever played C4 against me.
That's
and it's funny. some old guy who plays C4 against me, and I'm like, well, so much for all my, you know, prep. And I get destroyed, but as it turns out, we did like 12 moves of theory accidentally. So I was just playing good moves and it worked out, but I still got destroyed pretty quickly. And that game like didn't really affect my soul in the same way that like the losses now, when I have like an OTB loss, it's just like crushing.
Yeah.
And I'm so invested in it. So at the time, 1645, I was like, yeah, I probably could have done better. Yeah, there were like some holes in my repertoire. Yeah, this, yeah, that. But only kind of since COVID did OTB become like the thing for me to try and prove my worth.
So for you, it was more like a fun, cool new experience that you weren't even sure how often you'd be able to repeat as a, you know, graduate student struggling to just, you know, be a grad student.
And it, as it turned out, my next tournament was that exact same tournament the next year. So I didn't touch it again for a full year.
Did you find a new sponsor this time around?
No, that one was on me.
You should find a sponsor for each of these events.
Yeah. Just let me know, guys. Let me go.
Yeah. If you want to sponsor Michael, let him know. He's up for it. Maybe he'll even put your face on his shirt.
There you go. On the jacket, probably.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. Definitely. Okay. What I haven't heard, I've heard some strategy here. I really haven't heard any tactics work yet. I haven't heard any end games work. You had sort of your brief foray into openings work. Have we been working on any of this, or is this just something that happens next?
No, it's been happening. Okay. After Silman, I will say it's been happening. So now we're, call it a year to 2 years after me going through Silman the first time. I've read a bunch of books at this point. None of them have been like game-changing books, except for the game collection ones where like I switched openings to the Caro because of Sarawan's life.
Because just of like, Sarawan's life?
Yeah, just the way he played the Caro and the way he talked about the opening, and he had like opening ideas and stuff from like the 80s. And I was like, oh, I've never even considered that. Sure, I'll play that. So I actually like switched to the Caro-Kann because of Chess Duels, you know, his games against Karpov.
And you switched to a 1980s Caro-Kann repertoire.
Exactly.
People are like, what the heck is happening? Yeah.
And it was never an issue, right? I didn't need to study any more than that. It was totally fine. So it was like affecting my chess, but it wasn't like the game changer like that first strategy book was. And then I had done kind of like a basic end game book. I don't remember if the first one I did was the Silman end game book. I know I did it at some point then. But I thought like, okay, I'm a PhD student. I'm clearly interested in chess. And I've been told that to do the endgame right, you got to learn it from first principles. So I busted out Dvoretsky's endgame manual.
Wow.
And it took me like 3 to 4 months to get through the first chapter. And then I realized that I had not learned a single thing. I had just made the moves on my board. And I was like, okay, never mind. Not gonna look at this yet. I found a much more approachable endgame book.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Pandolfini's endgame book. Silman's endgame book, much, much more approachable, much better for me and probably everyone else until you're like masterclass.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if I'm ever good enough to get the endgame manual, cool, but my guess is I won't be, and that's fine. My favorite endgame book is Endgame Strategy by Sharashevsky. That's one that I'm tempted to read. I think I've already read it 1.5 times. I'm tempted to just go back again, though. It's just such a good book. Have you ever had a chance to read that at all?
I've finished the first chapter. I finished the fourth chapter. And then occasionally popped in on some people who were like going through the book in like various other points. So like did a little bit of different parts. But I personally have never gone through it. It is on my list. It's coming up sometime soon.
What's chapter 4? I don't know off the top of my head.
I don't remember. I just remember that time, that week, we were doing chapter 4. That's like, all right, I'm here for it. Let's see what we got.
I'm getting it off my shelf now. I just have to know what chapter 4 is.
Yeah, here I can know.
Okay, chapter 4 is the problem of exchanging.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. My favorite chapter is chapter 6, schematic thinking. That just completely changed how I think about endgames, because it was like, when I enter an end game now, I'm like, what are my mini plans, right? Like, probably I want my king to the center. Oh, I have a light squared bishop. I probably want to get the pawns off the light squares. I've got the potential to make a passer here on the queen side. And before that chapter, the way I did end games was like this. I got a lot of pawns.
Yeah. Wow.
Let's push. Maybe I could push some of them. I don't know.
Pushing, baby.
Yeah. So that really changed just the way I think about end games. And I think, like you said, we each have that book. For you, it's Reassess Your Chess. For me, it's Endgame Strategy and Pachman's Modern Chess Strategy, which, by the way, I don't recommend even to people because it has the old notation. There isn't even an updated version. Oh. So I'm like, no, I'm not even going to recommend this. I'm not going to be that guy who's like, you got to read this book.
This one book will change your life.
Strategy book there is. Okay. So did you read Capablanca's endings either?
Yeah. So, I've gone through that one more recently, actually. So I don't know if I should call it below my level, cause that sounds like too, put my nose up kind of thing. But yeah, it's a good book. And I do feel like at this point, I've already like seen 75% of those games on like a Ben Feingold lecture, on a Yasser lecture from Chess Club St. Louis kind of thing. Or I've just like flipped through basically at this point, all of the world champions, like their best games on chessgames.com kind of thing, and analyze them myself. So at this point, I have kind of like seen the vast majority of those books, of those games in that book. Great book though. Really, really good book. Yeah. I like how it explains the things very cleanly, very clearly, very short. It's not a huge, it's a huge variation that proves some point. It's like, no, you get your king up in the middle game. You get a pass pawn this way. You attack the weaknesses this way. It's very, very clear.
Yeah, going through Capablanca's games like that is so weird because it feels like he just doesn't care about openings.
Yeah.
And he can trade down to any endgame and win it.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, I'm like, ah, the simplicity. On the other hand, I'm like, I don't think I can just trade down to any end game and win. I think I can lose most of these end games. So, yeah, I'm not sure what lessons I'm taking other than the principles of end game play, which have been incredibly useful.
Yeah, there's been a few examples in that book, though, where I see the way he activates the rook and it sticks with me. And it's just like, oh, man, like, I didn't realize you could do this kind of thing where you like switch to this side, you're threatening to infiltrate, they have to defend, and then you make like a waiting move and it's like, oh, they can't make the same waiting move, and then you can switch back and like infiltrate. And it's just like this idea of infiltration with the rooks in the end game. He just does so like flawlessly. I don't know. He's so good. Capablanca is so good.
And those waiting moves, like there's a whole chapter in Endgame Strategy called Do Not Hurry. That's about that. And that's so impossible because whenever I'm like, all right, my opponent's got nothing, I'm just going to not hurry. They're like, yes, I do have something. And now you're dead. And I'm like, ah.
Yeah.
And then the games where I'm like, oh no, I better do something. I look back and I'm like, wait, they had nothing. They literally couldn't move a piece. And I had a million ways to win it. Instead, I blew it. So to me, that's just such a hard concept that I know the concept very well. But actually playing it in my games is so challenging.
And that's the other thing that people talk about when it comes to like Silman also, right? Because that's his style. He's a very boa constrictor type of style. Yeah. And how do you learn that if you're 1800 Lee Chess, right? Like you're going to miss something and then the whole thing goes to hell because you lost a pawn and then you lost two pawns and then your whole queen side falls. So I've had a few games like that and they feel really, really good, but only in like an OTB 90 plus 30 or more time control do you really have the chance to like actually put that in practice, I feel, because it just doesn't happen in Blitz. It doesn't happen in 15-10 really.
This is how I play all my games, man. All my games I'm trying to do that, and it's such a gut punch when you miss the one little thing.
Yeah.
But when you're playing for the subtle nuanced advantage, the one little thing unravels everything. Whereas if you're in a tactical melee and you leave a pawn and you're like, you know what? I didn't even care about that pawn. I'm going for your king. Whereas every pawn is devastating.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So hard. Okay. So where are we at now? I think we were at like 2100 Lee Chess. You've gone to your first tournament. You had a good time. You're at 1600. What happens next for you?
Yeah, so I go back in the next year. I'm still in my 1600s, but the first time around, I got three wins, three losses, one draw. The next time around, I got three wins, three draws, one loss. So it was a much, much better performance against the same competition. Yeah. So I was feeling good about that. And I was getting excited for the next one, but immediately afterwards is COVID. So yeah, I basically had a lot of time on my hands and I wasn't doing too hot when it came to my studies. And so I was like, let me go pick up some chess books to actually get the brain thinking again, because that's the same way that I got out of my previous rut when I had cancer. So I was like, all right, let me do it when we got COVID here. I didn't have COVID, but it was like, I just couldn't, I was just stuck in the house kind of thing. So that was the moment when I read like so many books, right? So there was, Flores del Rios's Chess Structures, Grandmaster Guide, great book. I read Essential Chess Sacrifices by this French guy, Lebrun. And it's like, here's when you sacrifice a knight on d5. Here's where you sacrifice a knight on f5. Here's where you play bishop takes h7. Here's where you play bishop takes h6. Here's where you play knight takes g7. There's just like all the piece sacrifices chapter by chapter. Oh. And I realized basically halfway through that book, I was like, huh, all the interesting sacrifices are in the open Sicilian.
Yeah.
And so that's when I switched to the open Sicilian.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was like, this is just so inspirational. Like every single game is just an open Sicilian. So, you know, I was like, all right, let's screw it. Let's go for it. And so I didn't really know any theory. And I said, I'll play the con because the con doesn't really have as much theory, right?
Sure.
Okay. Now that's not really true, but that's what I felt.
Yeah.
And I just started playing the open Sicilian as white, and I started playing the Sicilian as black, and I started sacrificing a lot more, and I started like actually playing as actively as possible a lot more. I was following Andras Toth, all of his kind of suggestions, where he's always like, don't respect your opponents, like they have to earn it kind of thing. Like you should be, you know, saying like, if that's a bad move, you should say it's a bad move. Like, no, not like, oh, h3, there's something deep here. It's like, no, you're moving a pawn on the side of the board. You're not playing in the center, time to crush kind of thing. And in the Sicilian, like you can actually make that happen. Whereas in the French and the Caro, it's closed sometimes. And it's hard to like, say like, oh, that's a poor move. Let me just like turn on death mode. So going through a lot of books like that, definitely doing a lot of long calculations also, like chess tempo tactics where they're like pretty high level ones where you have infinite time. They can be pretty deep, and you really have to like search for your opponent's resources and search for your resources. And it's like a lot of thinking ahead, not just like finding a tactic. So
did you read anything about calculation, about like calculation methods or calculation puzzles or anything like that?
Not in 2020, but since then I have. I really liked what's it called? It's called it's Smith. It's Axel Smith. Pump Up Your Rating. Pump Up Your Rating talks about that.
Yeah,
and chapter on that. Yeah, that one I think really stuck with me, and I really liked that book also. And I read that book maybe in 2021. That wasn't 2020 yet, but
yeah, that's a really great book. I think for like, you've got your first strategy book under your belt, maybe even a second one, and then Pump Up Your Rating goes so deep into like pawn breaks and calculation. And it's just, I bought it just for the pawn break chapter. And I was like, I need a chapter just on pawn breaks. And it was really great. He's a great author.
And yet he doesn't even call it a pawn break, right? He calls it a pawn lever.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. I was like, wait, what? And then I started calling it that. And people were like, what's a pawn lever? And I was like, what? And I'd show them, they're like, that's a pawn break. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, I never got on board with his terminology there. But I do really like the lifeline one, where you take a piece and it kind of like defends your other piece, like through it kind of thing. So that one I think about all the time. That book definitely stuck with me. There were a few things there. There was one phrase, literally one phrase just changed my chess from that book. All right.
Oh, wow.
He said, if you've got two rooks and your opponent has one rook, you should trade the rook, because then you're the only one who has a rook.
There you go.
And he doesn't have a rook. You have a rook. You're up a rook. I was like, oh my gosh. That is just such a game changer. And I played like a 15-10 game after reading that, where I had two rooks, they had one rook, and I couldn't infiltrate. I was like, how do I break in? And I was like, just trade a rook.
Yeah.
I traded one rook.
It kind of feels like if you're up a rook, you should be able to win anyway. But okay.
No. I wasn't like up a rook, but it was
like up an exchange.
It was like up an exchange for two pawns kind of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I just traded one pair of rooks, and then I'm the only dude with a rook, and my rook just infiltrates perfectly, hits everything, and I win because they don't have a rook anymore.
Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah. One phrase from Axel Smith changed your life.
Yeah. So good.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, what are some other books that you feel like had the biggest impact? Because like looking at your list of books on Reddit was quite lengthy. I guess I have two questions. The first one is, how do you have so much time to read that many books? And then the second question is, what are the most game altering for you?
Yeah. So to answer the first one, someone actually asked me in the comments, basically like, how many hours have you spent on all these books? And I just kind of estimated it. I came up with basically 64 days
Oh, wow.
It took me 64 days, 24 hours times 64.
That's a lot.
To read these books over like 8 years. So it's not like I had a lot of time to just do this on the side. Like this was the main focus for me. Like I'm going to go through these books, I'm going to learn this stuff, and then I would be playing games on the side. So I would play maybe for 1 week, I would play like three or four of these 15-10 games. And then for like a month, I'm like reading a book and I'll play maybe a game in that whole month. Kind of thing, you know. I'll play blitz games, sure. I'll play some bullet games casually on the side, sure. But like the serious games where I actually care, no, like I'd go a month without any game. So it's all the book. I'm going through the book.
That's interesting, because I feel like that flies in the face of a lot of advice I've heard lately, which is kind of like playing is the most important, and then the studying is something you do in addition to it. Because I'm with you. I would just spend most of my time reading books and occasionally play. And I've been trying to make an intentional effort to flip that. Do you feel like that just wasn't true for you and it's different for different people? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, two thoughts, really. In classical, I think the books matter more. So when you're focused more on OTB, I feel like the books matter more. When I play an OTB game, I will analyze it for longer than it took me to play the game. Right? I'm going to be in the cave kind of with my head down, really focused on what should I have done better? And then I'll ask some friends like, hey, this is my game. Here's all my annotations. Like, I was really worried about this move. I was really worried about this position. What do you think? And they're like, oh, you're an idiot. Like, clearly this would have been fine for you. Oh, this is not a big deal at all. This is completely winning for you here. This is winning for you there. This was completely lost. I don't know why you even spent time calculating that, stuff like that. And then you would turn on the engine and then kind of put all of the minds together, right? The friend's minds, my in-game mind, my analysis mind, and then the engine at the end to kind of say like, okay, here's the real truth, if you will. Yeah. And so like the game is really important. The analyzing is even more important. And then because I'm spending so long on that, it's like I don't feel the need to play another game because I just basically played like three or four more games from that one game.
That makes sense.
But I do hear exactly what you're saying. And I also agree that it's very easy to kind of just go from book to book and never play a game. You don't get past it until you play the game. So if you're just kind of reading a whole bunch of books and not actually playing, and it's not just playing Blitz, like you have to play the game where you care a lot about it. And it's like, I need to give my all for this game. Then the books won't really have much of an effect and you're not really improving.
That makes sense. I also really like what you said. There's your in-game mind and your analysis mind.
Yeah.
Because you can fall into these traps in the game where you just are seeing ghosts and like conjuring up things that aren't there. And then when you look at it in like just analysis mode, you're like, wait, what was I even talking about? Like that piece is guarded. Even like I thought it was hanging and it's guarded. It just like ridiculous things will happen in the moment. Just yesterday we went over this horrible loss I had on Wednesday, and my coach is like, well, why didn't you think about trading here? And I was like, well, then their H file's open and I was just, their rook is there and I was a little worried they'd had this attack on my king. And he just like broke into Andres talk mode for a second. He's like, what the F are you even talking about? And I was like, wow, okay. I guess I deserve that. Oh, it was funny.
But that'll stick with you, right?
Oh, yeah, so exactly.
Next time,
I'm going to get mated in the same way. And he'll be like, what? Why didn't you worry?
Yeah, that's another thing also. As I've improved, I keep coming up with the conclusion time and time again, that like the general rules are irrelevant and it all is concrete. It's chess is so concrete. So it's like every time you think like, oh, I should play knight f1 to defend stuff because there's no mate because I got my knight on f1, right? And it's like, no, like you got to play actively in the center. And like, just because there's a rule, you know, you can't get mated doesn't mean that that's going to be a correct move kind of thing.
Yep.
So yeah, it's really easy to fall into that trap, which is like, I know this one idea, let me try and apply it here, when it's just not, it doesn't apply there. And you got to be more like concrete. And that's
exactly what happened in our game, because he had a lot of stuff and then he's like, okay, let's do it. Let's play the next four moves. And it was like each thing that I thought they had, he's like, yeah, but you refute with this. And you refute it with this. And I was like, so actually he does have a good attack here. It just concretely, it doesn't work. And I didn't look at that. I just looked at the attack and went, there's an attack. And I didn't do what you're talking about, which is like, actually look at the moves. It's not about the motif. It's about the moves. Yeah. So that can be frustrating. Okay.
Exactly.
So the answer to the question of how did you read so many books is you took a heck of a lot of time and read a lot of books. That's the answer.
Yeah, definitely. And it helps that, you know, COVID gave me some more extra time to kind of do that. And it helped that my wife is, you know, always happy when I go into the dungeon for a little bit and she can, you know, go horse riding or something.
oh, that's cool. See, I have a different experience because I have two younger children.
Yeah,
that so makes it's a lot like, more complicated. But whenever I do that, it's like, dude, what are you doing? Get out here.
Yeah, exactly. That makes it a lot more complicated.
Okay, interesting. So what books have the biggest impact for you?
Exactly, to answer this question. Different books have impacted me at different times. So definitely Silman, that's up there for sure. I would say the game collections, Saruman's Chess Duels, like I just switched all of my openings just based on his annotations because I was like, I want to play like this dude because this is great.
Yeah, I kind of want to play 1980s Caro-Kann now. Yeah. Maybe I'm going to get this book.
Yeah, it's great. It's a lot of fun too. Like his annotations and his storytelling. I mean, it's top notch. It's he's great. Awesome. Pump Up Your Rating, really good book. Highly recommend. I also liked. I did read Woodpecker Method. I've only gone through the beginner and the intermediate one, so that's like 900 something puzzles. I haven't done all of them yet. Okay. I'm not completely sold on the efficacy of the method itself, but the tactics in the book are spot on. So they're really, really good, interesting tactics to like just think through.
I agree. And what rating would you put some of these at? Where do you put Pump Up Your Rating?
Pump Up Your Rating is one of those that you could really, I agree with you. It's like once you've got some basic strategy under your belt, you could already read it. Hmm. I think it's best if you're someone who like cares about OTB more than you're someone who's playing online a lot. But I think you could read that honestly like 1300 OTB and get a lot from it. And you could also get a lot from it if you're like 1900, 2000 OTB. Yeah. I think that's that one's pretty good and pretty general. Brickhard Strategic Chess Exercises is a tough one. And I said 1700 plus for that one probably. Okay. Really, really good. And if you like game, like annotated games, then you could pick it up just for that and just know that you're not going to like get a lot of these solutions correct, but then you get all the solution
take 10 minutes, fail, and then just get a good annotated game.
Exactly.
Yeah. That sounds fun.
It's a great book because it's got everything all in one. That one, definitely really affected me. I will also say that I went through, I'm in the Chess Dojo program, and so they asked us to go through the Polgar Million Mates book. I've done 3,000 of these mates now.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. And like starting from number 1471, I know the exact number where it changes from here is sack, sack, mate, sack, sack, mate, sack, sack, mate. It changes to the king is in a box, find some quiet move that lets him out of the box, but not actually because then he's in Zugzwang and then you have another mate here kind of thing.
Oh, geez. Okay.
So I've done like 1,500 of those. And I can tell you that it honestly helped me. I didn't think it would, but it honestly, it forced you to look broad and not deep. And that's something I had not really done before. And it's helped my calculation a lot more because I don't miss things. I'm much broader of a calculator now than a deep calculator.
Okay.
That genuinely has been helpful.
Yeah, it sounds like exactly what I need because my coach and I have been talking about this a lot that I calculate very well, but I rarely calculate my opponent's best move. And so it's like this horrible thing where I can convince myself that my move not only is good, but wins the game, but it in fact loses the game because my opponent just has this very obvious good move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe that
that's another thing though, that like when you're analyzing the game, both, you know, you by yourself and you with the coach, right? You get to see your in-game calculation and then you can compare it to reality. So you, by analyzing the games, you just get like multiple lessons in one. I love analyzing my games. It's so good.
I do, but it's usually cruel and you have to know that going in.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so the Polgar mates are actually helpful. Jesse Cry will be so happy to hear you say that.
He would love to hear that. I know. I didn't believe it. And I remember I failed the first time I got that book like 8 years ago. But I cracked it open again and I tried. I did 3,000 of them and all of the main threes as well, which are all sac-sac mate as opposed to the main twos where they're all like impossibly complicated, quiet moves and then set up some crazy mate. Okay. Yeah, it genuinely has helped.
Any other books you want to point to?
I would say those are the main ones that had a biggest effect, but definitely going through Silman's book, A Complete Endgame Force. I've now done that one as well two or three times. And that's just because you got to know the theoretical endgames and they've popped up and I'm pretty good about the theoretical endgames now. So that's not really holding me back anymore.
Yeah, I really love the breakdown of the book as well, where you can take your rating band and just process that piece. I have a friend, he's like 1000chess.com. Mm-hmm. And he asked me, he's like, I'm bad at endgames. What should I do? And I recommended the book and he got it and he refused to open it. He's like, Kevin, what are you doing, man? This book's like 1,000 pages. Like, no, your section's like 17 pages. And he's like, nah, I'm never opening this book.
Oh man, well, you even got the book.
I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
How about 100 endgames you must know, or as I call it, like 10,000 endgames you must know. Have you tried that at all?
Yeah, I've gone through about a third of it. I like how in the introduction, the author is like, hey, you only need these 20 endgames.
Yeah.
And you'll get to 2,000 FIDE. So like, you don't actually need this book. You just need these 20 endgames and here's the numbers.
Oh wow, I haven't read that. Okay, I'm gonna do that.
It's in the intro. It's in the intro.
Okay.
I don't know if it's there in the chessboard course, but I have the book and in the book it literally says these are the end games you actually need to know to get to 2,000 FIDE, and the rest of this is for people who want a thorough understanding of the end game.
Okay, so it's 20 end games you must know. Even more reasonable.
Exactly.
Okay.
So those are good. Those are really good. I thought the book was pretty good. I had already done Silman before. I'd already done Pandolfini before. I'd already kind of done Helston's Mastering Endgame Strategy before, done some of the Capablanca stuff. So, and I'd done a little bit of Dvoretsky. So when I went into 100 Endgames You Must Know pretty recently, I only did those and I basically already knew them. So it wasn't a game changer for me.
You're 2000 FIDE now. That's awesome. Good for you.
I'm getting there, man. I'm actually close. It actually feels good.
Nice. That's awesome. What is your rating today then?
So my rating today is 1911 USCF.
Okay.
And it has been on a steep incline.
That's awesome.
Since COVID. I've basically been gaining 50 rating every single tournament since COVID. Mm. So I was 1680, then I was 1730, then I was 1780, then I was 1800, then I was 1850, then I was 1911. And those are individual tournaments.
See, this is weird. You do not look 12 to me.
I know, right? I'm doing it because I'm catching up because I put in all the sweat work during COVID and we're finally catching up.
Every 10-year-old's journey at our chess club. They come in as 1,200, but they're actually good. Yeah. And then we have to all donate our points to them while they catch up to us.
I've been beating my fair share of those 12-year-olds and it is not easy. they are tough. They are really tough.
Well, that's remarkable. Certainly one of the great things about being underrated is that feeling of just getting to climb and climb. So it sounds like you've been playing a lot more OTB since COVID then.
Yeah. I finally had the time because I graduated from my PhD. And once I graduated, I joined the Chess Dojo program and they're like, guys, you have to play classical. Okay. 15-10 doesn't count. Blitz does not count. It hurts.
So
you have to play classical. And I was like, I wanted to play classical. I was getting into the OTB and they structure the program where you have to give them basically, well, the equivalent of your FIDE rating. Mm. And if you go by my online accounts, it's close to 2000 USCF. Yeah. If you go by my USCF, it was 1681. And I was like, okay, I got to prove it. I got to prove it to myself that I deserve the promotion to get to whatever I say that I should be, that I actually should get there. So I've been playing basically one tournament every 3 months.
Okay, that's cool. Let's talk a bit about the Chess Dojo, because I know I tried it very briefly with 1.0. Yeah. I thought it was really cool. There were a lot of things I loved about it. I will say, I was very frustrated at that time about their claim that only whatever time control counted, because I was playing weekly OTB, but it was only like, we only have time for like 55-5 games. And they're like, no, that doesn't count. And I was like, what? And that was a little bit frustrating for me in that time. But I love the idea of having a clear training plan. I love the idea of having all these built-in training partners. So there are so many parts of the program that I really, frankly, didn't have time to take advantage of. So I'm curious to talk to somebody who has had the opportunity to dive in. What have you found to be the biggest upsides of this program?
Yeah, the biggest upside is the sparring and the group focus on classical, because everyone is invested in basically improving their chess and not their blitz chess, right? There's a lot of discords out there where everyone's like, all right, I'm spamming blitz. Like, how did I lose this game? Oh, I flagged here. Oh, this bullet guy is too good. Oh, I need to work on my openings. Yeah. And it's a breath of fresh air to kind of find a group of people where, first of all, we're vast majority of us are adults, so we can actually like talk to each other also in like a VC and just have a normal conversation.
That's other than nice. Chess Latte, I run into him at events.
he's near you.
Yeah.
he's been on my heels in the rating graph section.
Uh-oh. Don't let him catch you. Those 12-year-olds, they level up fast.
Yeah. So it's good to just have a group of people where that's the focus. So that's honestly in of itself something that I really like. I agree that they are very strict about the time control. It hasn't really bothered me too much, because when I don't have time to put a game in the database, I'll still do the same thing that I did for those games that I do put in the database that are the 90-30s that, you know, satisfy their little check mark. And I kind of put in all the same amount of effort, and I'll share it with people either in that Discord or outside that Discord, even if I'm not going to then submit it and, you know, say, oh yes, I've played one more classical game in your little scoreboard thing. Yeah. So that to me is not a game changer, but I can understand why it's frustrating, especially if like that's the time control you have near you. The closest tournament basically for me is always like 3 hours away. So that's, you know, it's a struggle.
Are you in the Berkeley area still?
No. So now I'm in Austin, Texas, and basically you can't find games in Austin that are going to be 90-30s.
Yeah.
There's one tournament coming up soon, actually, but I unfortunately can't do it now that I got the puppy. But Houston and Dallas have the vast majority of the tournaments. So I've been driving to Houston and Dallas every 3 months or so to do these weekend ones. Yeah.
And if you're on the East Coast, that'd be like a half hour, but in Texas, that's like 9 hours, probably. That state's so big.
Yeah, it's legitimately more than 3 hours to get to the two closest cities, except for San Antonio's closer. Yeah,
that kind of surprises me that Austin, with, I don't know, just how I think of Austin, I would think chess would be pretty big in Austin. There'd be a club and there'd be weekly, you know, tournaments. So
there is a club. They play a lot of blitz. Weekend blitz events definitely are there. And there's a lot of different scholastic opportunities in the city. But then if you want 90-30 games, you can't really find them. Sometimes in Waco, which is like an hour and change away, you can find them. Okay. But otherwise, Houston and Dallas is just 3+ hours.
I feel like you got a real business opportunity. I know. Start 90-30 tournaments. You could probably make like $8.
Brutal. Yeah.
Okay. So you found really, have you been able to do a lot of sparring then within the dojo? Have you been able to find people to spar like end game positions and middle game positions, or what's the sparring been like for you?
Yeah, I have less the middle game positions that they have, and much more the end games. Everyone's always like trying to nail those algorithms, and everyone's trying to like nail the interesting end game positions that like Jesse's kind of picked out that are kind of insightful and interesting. Yeah. Where it's not just like a, you know, rook and single pawn kind of end game, and it's like a complicated, here's a knight, rook, and bishop, and knight, rook, and bishop, and how do you maneuver kind of thing. So yeah, those definitely I've had some good sparring on, and it's just good because you can talk to the people afterwards and you can really give each other all the thoughts. It's a thought dump, and then you improve. Yeah, that's just how you improve.
Yeah.
I wish I had more people that played like my openings, my specific openings, because then I would happily spar the openings. But it just so happens that in the 1900 cohort, there's only so many active people, and none of them are really playing what I play. So I'm not going to bore them playing both sides.
Well, surprise. I mean, the Sicilian is such a popular opening. I'm surprised more people aren't playing that as white.
I know. As white, they will play into the Sicilian, but as black, they don't play the Sicilian.
Okay.
So since you're supposed to kind of play both sides of it, it's tough.
And what Sicilian are you playing these days?
I am still playing the Khan. So it's been now 3 years with the Khan.
Okay.
And I can now see that I was silly for saying basically, oh, I'll play the Khan because there's no theory, because there's just as much theory in the Khan as there is the Night Orc. The only difference is maybe some people don't know it. But yeah, I've got horror stories out of that opening. So I should have just picked one of the default ones just to make my life a little bit easier, even though it would have been a lot more theory. It's just still a little bit easier. There's some variations, man, where I don't know. I've looked at it with an engine. I really looked at it in detail, and I got nothing. It's just a solid plus one everywhere you look.
Oh, no. Yeah, the problem for me with the Nidorf when I was playing it, everyone played either like the English attack, the poison pawn, or the Sozin. And that was it. And then I came back like 20 years later and people are playing like H3 and this, and I'm like, what is happening? And they're like, oh, it turns out there's 87 answers to the Nidorf. And I was like, well, I can't memorize all of them. What is happening?
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that Nidorf theory got that much bigger when it was already enormous. So I just feel like with the amount of time I can put into chess, I felt personally like I had a choice. I could either dump all of it into openings or actually learn how to play chess.
Right. And that's the other thing that I totally agree with. I am losing out of the opening. I'm telling you, I am lost, like straight up lost out of the opening. And it does not affect the result of the game.
Yeah.
You know, I'll have to grovel. I'll probably not get a win, but I can get a draw against people that are 2000 USCF from terrible positions, because that's not the end of the game. The game is not end because you have a bad opening.
So, that's true.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it. That's fine.
The other day, that game I was talking about that I played, my coach went over it. I was just getting crushed in the opening. And he's like, you played it all wrong. Like everything you did was wrong. And I was like, I know. And he's like, you can't even get your pieces out. And I'm like, I know. And then within four moves, he's like, you're winning. And I was like, I know. I felt like I was winning here. And he's like, see, the openings don't even matter. You can just play ridiculous and still be fine.
Yeah.
And then I after feel the that. Game was over, even he's like, I just want to remind you, you did not lose in the opening. You lost three different times, twice in the middle of the game and once in the end game. And I was like, yes, I know. I am aware. Thank you.
And that's why I think like you can pick up the Nidorf again, honestly, and just not learn theory. Like just forget the theory, just think thematically, and you can make it work.
That sounds really fun. I love the Nidorf. I would have never switched if people didn't play the Alapin, the Close, the Rosalimo, whatever other nonsense they're going to do.
Yeah, and I get that too, right? So like I'm playing the Sicilian and I'll get the Close Sicilians 50% of the time, and you just get a position and it's supposed to be equal. So good that we get a game and I don't know any theory and they don't know any theory and we're just playing. So that's good. Yeah, I'm happy with that too.
Or you could just stare them in the eye,
call
them a chicken, and then flip the table and walk out of the room. I think that's a legit option.
That's the tabletop simulator move, right?
Exactly. That's the TTS move. Can't do that as easily in real life, because oftentimes you would have to flip over like two other people's games also. You're very unpopular if you make that decision.
Oh, man.
You know, one thing I haven't heard is coaches. Yep. Have you had a chess coach at all, or have you just been like, I'm doing fine, I know what I need to improve at, and I do it?
I have received one-on-one coaching exactly once. From Grandmaster Gary. I should say FM Grandmaster Gary. The username does not reflect his strength. He's a great teacher, but we only kind of scheduled one, and then his schedule got way too busy because his stream like totally took off and he has like way too much going on. So that was really fun, and actually really helpful. But that was the only one-on-one coaching I've ever received. I was in the Chessbra camp where we all went to Tulum, Mexico, and we had a serious camp in the morning to like middle of the day, and then it was chess broad night, so like parties and drinking and blitz chess and nonsense, right? So it was a lot of fun. And there we had like some featured, I'll call it sparring for lack of a better term, where you would just like spar people that were in your, for lack of a better term, cohort, right? So you had the beginners, intermediates, and advanced. And yeah, I was doing some good games there. So we were analyzing together kind of thing there. We were doing some end game studies there. And that was similar to kind of the coaching vibe also. Nice. So it's been, I guess, a week in the day of serious coaching. Interesting.
Because it sounds like you've had great experiences with coaching. So why not add more of those experiences?
Yeah. I mean, why not? There's no reason why not.
Okay.
Maybe the reason why not is money is one aspect of it. I think it's like I already have so many things that I know I need to do and want to do that a coach would be helpful, but also not necessary.
Okay.
Right. So like there's, I already know my next like three or four books that I want to read. Right. So I still need to finish Woodpecker Method. I'm reading Think Like a Super GM by Michael Adams, where he's one of a few authors. And then my next book is going to be Sam Shanklin's Small Steps to Giant Improvement. So like I have it, yeah. You know, that's going to take some time. And I need to play some classical OTB games because the dojo tells me I got to play those 90-30s. And I know I need to do that. And I agree I need to do that. And I got to analyze more of my 15-10 games and just put in the effort. So I already kind of know what I want to do for the near future. So then I don't feel like the need to get a coach. But I'm sure a coach would help. Like every time, it's always been useful.
Yeah. It sounds kind of like the chess dojo is a replacement in some way because it's keeping you accountable,
right?
Giving you some sort of program. Yeah. It has a bit of the plus minus where you're able to spar and talk about the games with people, probably sometimes who are better than you. So maybe that alone is sort of a replacement.
Yeah, I actually do agree. It's not going to be as good as a one-on-one coaching session, but everything you just said, completely agree with. Yeah.
Yeah. Also a lot cheaper than a one-on-one coach.
For sure. It's 100 per year. That's like a coach for 1 hour.
Yeah. That is pretty much one coaching session.
Yeah. I can tell you that I do coaching actually. And it's not, I'm a lot more expensive than I would be willing to pay.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you do some chess coaching?
Yeah. Yeah. I've coached two or three people now.
Nice. That's awesome. So are you taking students?
I will say yes, although it depends how many people contact me.
Okay.
So this is very much a side gig. This is not.
So here we go. I mean, if you want a coach who is expensive and good and exclusive, he might not even take you. Michael might be available. He might not.
I'm pretty good. I got experience teaching, you know, in real life because of the grad school, right? So
yeah, I feel like it's a similar thing, right? Like I'm a high school teacher and I think I'd be a good chess coach, but it's that thing of, like you said, it's like there's only so much time. And for me, if I did chess coaching, it would come directly out of my own chess improvement time. I wouldn't be able to carve like this new bucket for that. And so it's made me very hesitant to go into it. I think it'd be very rewarding to work with one or two students closely who are really dedicated to improving their maybe like around 1100 or something. I think that would be perfect for me personally.
Yeah, it's cool. It is really cool. I've got one person I've been working with for a while, and they have improved dramatically. Like in the beginning, 1100 is probably above what they were at, but now they're a solid 1900 Lee chess player, 2000 Lee chess player kind of thing on a good day. And they've read a bunch of books and we've gone through some stuff together, and they have a really good understanding, if not necessarily that concrete thinking that I keep coming back to, where it's like it all comes down to the concrete stuff. Yeah.
I only have one student. She's 8. She's rated about 200 and she is not interested in chess improvement or doing anything chess related other than playing. I don't understand my daughter. She loves playing OTB tournaments. And that's it. She only wants to do that. And I'm like, boy, like you're going to lose a lot of games doing that. Like it's just, that's the hardest environment to play chess. People are the most geared up to do well. And she's like, yeah, I just like going. It's fun. I'm like,
cool.
We're different people and I'm going to support you. That sounds great. All right. Well, Michael, I feel like there's like 10 other topics I'd like to get to, but we've been at it for a long time. So I think I'm just going to have to say this wraps up the first conversation. We'll do this again in a few months. We'll figure it out where you are there. Then we'll talk about your awesome Lee chess studies and all the other amazing things you do. So, Michael, where can people contact you if they just want to reach out for questions or, I don't know, join your exclusive coaching club? How can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, the best way is probably on Lee Chess. If you just message me, nose knows all on Lee Chess, I will respond probably within a day or two at most.
Okay, excellent. So there we go. Yeah. Well, Michael, it's been such a great conversation. It's great to talk to somebody who's been having such a momentous and awesome climb to the top while I race back down to zero.
Oh, man.
There's a friend and I, we were racing to 1,800. We're now racing to 1,500. So it's become a very different race.
I will say one bit of advice just for you in particular. You got to have the confidence when you're at that board. You got to just say, I can beat this guy. I don't care what their rating is. I don't care if they're a chessable nerd. I don't care if they're a small kid. You can beat them. And if you go into it with that attitude, then you actually can beat them. Because I guarantee you, you've got chances in all these games that you're losing and all these games you're drawing. I guarantee you.
I do. I've got a friend. He says, we got to bring out Killer Kevin.
Yeah.
So that's, it's hard because I put him in a box because I used to have a real problem with being too competitive. And so I locked Killer Kevin away and he's like, no, just let him out for games and then put him back in. I'm like, I don't know if I can contain him that way. Like he's like his own entity. So we'll see. Maybe we'll let him out of the box a little bit and see what happens.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll end up screaming at 11-year-olds. Who knows what could happen?
I have made a few 11-year-olds cry, and I will not say that it makes me feel good because it does not, but it is part of the game.
Yeah.
The truth hurts.
It is. Well, Michael, thanks so much for the chat. For all of you out there, I hope this is your week where you pull a nose knows all and you gain, I don't know, like 300 points just from one book. That sounds amazing. But if you're like me and USCF sends you a message about how they hate you and your rating keeps dropping, you know, it happens, I guess. So hopefully next week we'll have another guest that will help you through your pain and process your grief. And I'll talk to you next time. Have a good one, everybody. Goodbye.